This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Anita Godis about her fascinating book published by Oxford University Press titled Repression in the Digital Age, Surveillance, Censorship, and the Dynamics of State Violence, which addresses, honestly, a whole host of questions. I won't give away just yet what they all are, but they are fascinating. They are relevant to research. They are relevant very much to everyday life in a lot of places. So for those reasons and more, Anita, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Miranda.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, so my name is Anita Godis. I'm a professor of international and cybersecurity at the Hertie School in Berlin. And I have been fascinated with studying state repression for as long as I can think. And the impetus for this book really came from non-academic work I was doing, or let's say academic work outside of the university. So when I had finished my master's, now more than a decade ago, I was working for a nonprofit organization called the Human Rights State Analysis Group. And in 2011, when the conflict, the civil war in Syria had commenced, the Human Rights State Analysis Group was approached by the UN, the UN Human Rights Office, to work with Syrian documentation groups on establishing the number of killed people who'd been killed by the regime in the conflict. And in this context, I was working with them as a very early PhD student, trying to help collect this data, clean the data, kind of use data science methods to work with the data. And these Syrian documentation groups were telling us that they were very, very reliant on, for example, Skype and other types of social media and communication apps to collect this data as quickly as possible. But that they were having a really hard time in some areas of the country because the government had shut down the internet. And in some cases, the government had even shut down the internet across the entire country for multiple days on end. And this was at a time, this was in 2011, 2012, when the kind of discourse around what social media and what the internet could do was extremely enthusiastic and positive. And there was this idea of liberation technology, and we would, you know, all just be moving towards democracy. And governments, especially repressive governments, weren't really able to do anything about that. And hearing these Syrian documentation groups with which we were working, telling us about all of these issues with the internet being shut down, made me really interested in studying how censorship and other types of internet controls could actually be instrumentalized by repressive governments. So a long answer, but this was really the initial impetus for me to study this topic.
Not a long answer, and certainly a very important one. So thank you for giving us that background. Obviously, with what you've just explained, that kind of gives us some ideas of what the book investigates. But I wonder if you can tell us more about the questions you ask in the research and how you developed these specifically.
I was really interested in understanding what happens when governments use the infrastructure power that they have to control the internet. And by infrastructure, when I think about digital infrastructure, I don't only think about the ability to provide internet access to people, but also to take it away. And when you provide internet access to people, to actually use those networks to surveil and see what they're doing. Again, if we kind of go back more than a decade ago in time and think about kind of what happened in 2012, 2013, the big global surveillance disclosures by Edward Snowden, we learned about the degree to which governments can actually use digital networks to surveil people. And so theoretically, I was really interested in, well, when are governments more likely to opt for surveillance, so to actually kind of use the networks that are in place, and when are they more likely to shut down the internet, so to take away people's abilities to use the internet? And that really was those were the two dimensions I was interested in studying. And at the time, we knew that governments were using censorship, and we knew that they were sometimes using them, for example, before elections or in the context of big protests, but we didn't really know what that did with more traditional forms of repression. So what the book really investigates is, how do these new forms of control, so surveillance, censorship, different types of censorship, different types of surveillance, coincide and are used alongside more traditional forms of state repression, such as killing people, torturing them, and arresting them in the context of protests, for example.
This is obviously why listeners, you're like, now I know why Miranda was excited about this book, right? Can you tell us a bit then about kind of how you go about answering these questions? Tell us a bit about the theory, the argument you're making there, and the sorts of data and case studies, especially, that you use to examine these theoretical ideas.
So studying the inner workings of governments, especially authoritarian governments, is very, very difficult. It's not as easy as, you know, talking to, you know, the public and seeing what they think. Oftentimes these things happen behind closed doors. And of course, when repression is involved, governments have a very big incentive to kind of hide or conceal what they're doing, or in some other way evade accountability. So there were kind of different ways in which I tried to approach this topic empirically and also theoretically. And the way I think about information control, cyber control, censorship, surveillance is very much in the context of what we know about authoritarian politics and what we know about the role of information in authoritarian politics. And there's a long-standing literature, a lot of this comes back to studying authoritarian regimes during the Cold War, but even before that, that thinks about how the control and the ability to have information and to withhold information from the kind of general population helps autocrats stay in power. And that ultimately there's this informational dilemma, right? Where on the one hand, you as an autocrat want to make sure that no one says anything bad about you. But on the other hand, if you don't have anyone saying anything bad about you, you might also not know how unhappy people actually are. And so what kind of in the pre-internet era, what a lot of authoritarian governments, including the former GDR, I live in Berlin, so this is kind of the former headquarters of the Stasi, right? What the Stasi would do would be develop these very, very intricate networks of informants who would try to collect as much information as possible on people who might be doing things that would be challenging to the regime stability. And so what I tried to do in this book was think about, well, if that's how things were done in the olden days, what can the internet actually do that goes beyond building networks of informants, or that goes beyond censoring what newspapers say, what people say on TV? And in some ways, what's happening online is not that different than these networks of informants, but in other ways, it is quite different. And the big difference that I identify, number one, is that these networks of informants took a very, very long time to put in place, right? You had to get the right people to work for you. They had to actually do their job. They had to bring the information back to you. They had to gain the trust of the people that they were surveilling. And online, we're sharing all kinds of things on social media, on apps that might not be encrypted, on dating profiles. You know, we're sharing our location with our phones. And if the government actually has the ability to collect that information, it gives them a whole different type and quality of information than might have been available in the pre-internet times. So the quality, the reach has changed. And especially these kind of marginalized groups that might have been critical of the government that were very, very difficult to penetrate with these original informant groups are easier to actually get access through the internet. And so in that way, surveillance online is kind of adding these new forms of high quality information. Now, the drawback is that no one actually is using their phone to be surveilled, right? That's not why we use our phones. And so what a lot of people, especially in authoritarian countries, are doing is going around their daily lives, but also, if they're unhappy, coordinating to maybe meet in a certain place and protest against the government, or talk about specific tactics that they're going to use, or talk about, you know, where the police might be hiding or trying to get a hold of them. And so there's this kind of trade-off on the one hand of having access to higher quality information, but then on the other hand, having the increased likelihood of these tools also being used for mobilization. And so that's where censorship then comes in, where we see that a lot of governments will say, well, actually, you know, this additional information that we have is quite useful, but every now and then we really want to make sure that no one can coordinate or communicate, and we're actually going to shut down access to the internet, either in a certain city or in the entire country, to make sure that no one has any way of finding out what other people are doing, and we can kind of start controlling the narrative again. Mm. And what I hypothesize is that the situations where surveillance is more likely to be used are also the situations where we're going to see more targeted, specific targeted forms of repression being used. So individuals are singled out, people are arrested, people are actually singled out as victims. And in situations where the government decides to shut down the internet, we're much more likely to see mass repression, more indiscriminate forms of repression, and much less of this kind of singling out selective violence.
All right. That was, I think, incredibly helpful in obviously the theoretical argument aspect, but also in helping us understand kind of who, in these sorts of contexts, who's using the internet or banning the internet or shutting it down, and sort of what, as you said, that back and forth was, the benefits and, of course, the risks, given how states can enact these repressive measures for the internet. So can we talk about Syria? Because the Syrian government does something actually almost the opposite of these repressive things, at least at first. If we go all the way back to early 2011, why did the Syrian regime lift a number of internet information controls? And what impact did this have, kind of, if we go right back to the beginning, so we can then have a better sense of what comes after?
If we go back to the beginning of what's been called the Arab Spring, and we saw mass protests in Tunisia, we saw mass protests in Egypt. Very quickly after those mass protests took off, the Syrian government actually unblocked or allowed access to a number of social media sites that were previously not available in the country. So, for example, Blogspot, Facebook was available, and there was a lot of discussion about why that might happen. And initially, some people said, oh, you know, this is a sign that there's going to be some opening within the regime. But very, very quickly, human rights activists within Syria said, no, no, this is actually a sign of the government trying to access information about what's actually going on and who might be a threat within their own country. And so I think this already indicates that there can be an interest in providing access to new forms of social media as a way of collecting information about who might actually be a threat to the regime. And we, of course, can only hypothesize about this, but people who know much more about Syria and much more about the government than me have all kind of pointed towards the fact that this was likely the motivation to unblock access to these websites.
Which then makes the contrast later on in the conflict even more stark. Can you talk us through sort of when, why did the Syrian government go from this to not just kind of putting back the restrictions that were there before, but then using full-on internet blackouts in specific places more than once?
This was something I was really interested in studying. Why does a government that has decided to unblock access to the internet or to important parts of the internet then suddenly shut down the internet? And what I actually studied was the first couple of years of the conflict and the kind of repeated nationwide shutdown of the internet. And I was interested to see how those shutdowns coincided with dynamics of violence that was that were perpetrated by the regime. And something that I find is that every single one of these internet shutdowns is accompanied by a stark, significant increase in the amount of violence used by the regime. And it's usually quite concentrated. So it's usually in the context of larger regional offensives where the government is, for example, fighting against an insurgent group and is shutting down the internet as kind of a concerted repressive effort to regain control of certain parts of the territory. And because these non-state groups were really, you know, pioneering actually if one might say the rebel use of social media, of Google Earth, of other types of apps that help them be better fighters, the surprise shutdown of the internet was a way for the government to gain a tactical advantage. And so we see that it coincides with a significant and substantial increase in the amount of violence used by the regime.
Can you take us a bit more into kind of how we figure that out, right? You mentioned earlier kind of obviously the challenges of investigating authoritarian regimes. Literally, how can we study the dynamics between sort of going, okay, there's this internet blackout, and then what the state does in that time and place? Can you walk us through sort of how you are able to piece these things together?
I think piecing it together is exactly the right language for this, because it was literally piecing it together. So I attempted to study the role of internet shutdowns at different levels. I look at them at a national level in Syria, and I study kind of the daily dynamics of violence. Then I also have a study where I go kind of subnational and look at regional shutdowns. And then at the end of the book, I also have kind of a cross-national study where I look at kind of worldwide what the role of internet shutdowns and repression is. But if we stick with Syria, the full circle moment is that we can really only study the correlation between shutdowns and violence because a lot of these documentation groups were able to collect this high quality information on regime violence because of the internet. So they were incredibly fast at creating lists and lists and lists and lists of names of people who'd been killed by the regime, and not just the names, where they were killed, under what circumstances they were killed, the date on which they were killed. And basically as much identifying information as possible to signal that these were not just made up names, that these were actually people who were killed. And so this was data that I collected together with my colleagues at the Human Rights Age Analysis Group, or better to say put together, because the data was collected by Syrian documentation groups, and was able to analyze using various statistical methods to see to what extent the dynamics of shutdowns coincide with spikes in violence. Now, the thing that makes studying information and violence incredibly challenging, and here it gets a little bit more technical, is the fact that, of course, the amount of information access you have is going to be correlated with the amount of information you have about what's going on. So when there's no internet accessibility, when there are fewer people around, for example, when violence is more intense, we're less likely to know about what's going on. And this goes for any type of conflict. What that means is that we need to use statistical tools to correct for reporting patterns in our violence, in our data, so that we can get a better estimate of the total amount of violence that occurred. So it wasn't enough for me just to say, okay, let's study to what extent reported violence coincides with internet shutdowns. I also had to account for unreported violence to see whether internet shutdowns were actually hiding what was going on or not. And what I find is that the shutdowns that were used in Syria really did not lead to massive reductions in reported violence. And that is likely because the shutdowns were quite short, and also because that probably wasn't the intention behind the shutdowns. It was much more about military goals and concerted repressive efforts than saying, oh, we want to hide what's going on here.
I wonder if I can ask kind of a further follow-up in the Syrian case. The use of full internet blackouts, I mean, you said you were intrigued by this, and I certainly was picking up the book, because there's a lot of things governments can do to restrict information by the internet that aren't as kind of extreme and that aren't as visible. Full-on blackouts are a pretty big deal, right? They tend to have some consequences, or at least maybe we think they have consequences rhetorically or reputationally. Given that there are other ways of suppressing information or monitoring information, why would a government like the Syrian one kind of keep going for the most extreme option?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I actually think we see in the case of Syria how the tactic changes a bit. So in the first years of the conflict, I studied nationwide shutdowns. And then starting in kind of 2013, 2014, a few years into the conflict, I then start studying regional shutdowns. And of course, again, this is my hypothesis, but we actually see that the usage of nationwide shutdowns really, really drops in Syria. And one of the things that was very apparent when kind of studying media coverage of these shutdowns was that in 2011, 2012, 2013, when the government shut down the internet nationwide, it just produced the biggest international headlines that you can imagine, right? So CNN was reporting about, the New York Times was reporting about, Al Jazeera was reporting about it. Amnesty International was, you know, sending out alerts about this because there was no information coming out of the country. Now, when the internet was not available in certain parts of the country, no one was reporting on this, because that's something that just the outside world doesn't observe quite as quickly. And so I think we see that in some circumstances, especially repressive governments have learned that more localized shutdowns can be very effective, but actually just don't produce as much negative press. And so I think that's why we're seeing kind of a move towards more regional shutdowns. And many, many governments actually engage in regional shutdowns. In Ethiopia, there was a very long regional shutdown. They occur quite often in Kashmir and in India. So these regional shutdowns are things that occur very, very often and just don't produce the negative types of press. The other type of censorship is shutting down access to specific web pages. And depending on what the web page is, that can go well. But if you shut down access to Twitter, for example, or if you shut down access to Facebook, then people are likely to be really up in arms about that as well. So it's a bit of a trial and error for governments to see what actually works.
Oh. Speaking of that, I wonder if we can move to talk about Iran. You speak in the book about how what happens after the 2009 elections, the protests after the elections, impact how the government thought about these questions, you know, thought about this trial and error of how do we achieve security and control information, but in ways that hopefully don't lead to more massive protests. Can you help us understand sort of what the government is thinking about and weighing up after the protests in 2009?
The Iranian case, I think, is quite similar to what we've seen many, especially repressive regimes, go through. And that is having kind of a big, almost like extreme event that really jolts them awake to the dangers of giving people free access to the internet. Many people have described the 2012 protests in Russia like this. Of course, also the 2009 protests in Iran as situations where the government, for the first time, really becomes aware of the damage from their perspective social media can do, because it allows people to coordinate, it allows people to quickly adapt their tactics, and it really makes it hard to control the narrative to the outside world. And so these kind of big initial events that kind of jolt awake the regime to these dangers can then oftentimes be traced in policy decisions that are made afterwards and in attempts to regulate online spaces in ways that kind of make sure that these types of big bursts of anti-government behavior are hopefully undercut or repressed in the future. And that's kind of what we see happening in Iran. Now, in Iran, after the 2009 protests, or, you know, very, very 1 or 2 years later, we have the big publication of the Stuxnet virus that was found to have been specifically developed to target Iran. And so the protests in Iran in 2009, together with the discovery of the Stuxnet cyber attack, really lead to a situation where the Iranian government, at least in its communication, says, look, we have to become more independent of the international internet, and we have to build our own national internet infrastructure that we can actually control, so that we can actually control what people have access to, how they can communicate, and also what types of apps they're using.
And is this the same sort of response that you found when you expanded your analysis beyond Syria and Iran? What were the sorts of things that you found on that kind of question, on this connection between internet disruption and the use of state-sanctioned violence? What happened when you expanded the lens?
One of the things that one might think about when one thinks about what the role of internet shutdowns could be is that internet shutdowns would be used as a preventative measure. And actually, a lot of governments that have engaged in shutting down the internet have said, we're doing this because we want to prevent violence, we want to prevent the stoking of fear and rumors online. And this is kind of a way to kind of dampen down contention within a country. And so that was kind of the prevailing, I might say, alternative explanation for what we might see the relationship between internet shutdowns and violence might look like. But what I find across the board is that even when we kind of statistically take into account all lots and lots of other explanations that could explain why governments use repression, states that engage in internet shutdowns are significantly more likely to engage in higher levels of state repression. So this is not something that is substituting for traditional forms of repression at all. It's something that is supporting the use of state repression. And that is something that I find in Iran, in Syria, but then also kind of across the board. So this is not, you know, when we hear the rhetoric around maybe information control being a way to prevent violence, we really have no empirical support for that.
Interesting. Was there anything during the process of researching or writing this book that you found particularly surprising or that was maybe not what you expected?
Yeah.
So I think what was interesting for me was to see just the degree to which governments, whether they're rich or poor or, regardless of what their colonial history, for example, is, or what regardless of what part of the world we're looking at, have started to really invest in information control. And, a lot of that has to do with learning from what other governments are doing. So again, if you kind of remember the global outcry around the global surveillance disclosures from Edward Snowden, there was kind of a lot of discussion about, now we know about the degree to which surveillance is possible, and that means that we can kind of now work towards this, preventing this from happening. But the other way to actually read those developments is that for the first time, a lot of especially repressive governments became aware of the capabilities that are out there. And so in a certain sense, it was, advertisement for what can actually be done in terms of online surveillance and controlling and filtering the internet. And so these kind of, when we have these big events where we learn about specific types of spyware and specific types of surveillance software and filtering software, the flip side of that is that It also becomes more knowledgeable especially for authoritarian countries that were previously maybe not aware of those capabilities. And so, you know, what we've basically seen across the last decade and a half is a continuous expansion of countries that are interested in gaining these types of capabilities.
Well, so that's one obvious reason why this book is important and has useful information for, I think, a lot of people in the research and policy worlds. Are there kind of, just besides the fact that more countries are getting interested, can you talk through some of the other implications of this research?
For me, one of the big implications really is to think about digital infrastructure in more ways than we currently are. I think we oftentimes talk about digital infrastructure as, you know, something that is important for economic development, for maybe for social development, right? There's a lot of really important research showing us that, you know, access to information can really empower women and it can help with better health outcomes and, you know, it's great for education. But digital infrastructure is just as, if not even more political than other forms of, you know, infrastructure provided by the state, because it can, you know, so easily be manipulated by especially repressive regimes. And so I think the way we think about the expansion of the internet across the world, you know, we should think about it beyond economic and kind of maybe educational terms and really think about it in terms of kind of civil and political rights as well. And I say this because one of the things I also found when researching for this book and building on work that some of my colleagues have done is that the makeup of the internet service provider sector, so how many people, you know, how many different internet service providers there are, whether they are state-owned or not, has a very big impact on the ease with which governments can actually engage in these types of tactics. And so these things are extremely political and they have huge implications for the level of openness of the online sphere. And then that has huge downstream effects for media freedom, for, you know, the freedom of minorities, LGBTQ groups, ethnic minorities, and so on and so forth. So we should really think about these things as very, very political terms that have big downstream effects.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And going back to, you know, combining that then with the idea of more countries being interested in it, lots of effects, lots of countries, a lot of attention probably needs to be on this. So an even more useful contribution to have this book. And it is out now, right? People can go read it. It's therefore off your desk. Is there anything you might be working on now that it's done?
Yes, it's quite surreal because I worked on it for a very long time to have it off my desk. I continue to be really interested in digital repression as kind of an umbrella topic, and something I've been working on for the last years is the specific targeting of journalists and the role of media freedom in all of this. So something I'm really interested in further studying are the specific tools in the digital sphere that are used to target journalists. And I think what's really interesting is that we have seen kind of a playbook develop of different types of tools of harassment, smearing, targeting, the use of spyware, discrediting, that have very, very heavily relied on social media and the internet, but that are being used against journalists all over the world. And I think that's something that's really interesting, and I really hope to do more research on that.
All right. Well, I think that's a fascinating topic. Maybe if it becomes a book, we can have you back.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Great. Well, in the meantime, while you work on that, listeners can read the book, again, titled Repression in the Digital Age, Surveillance, Censorship, and the Dynamics of State Violence, published by Oxford University Press. Anita, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda.